Hey, it's Jake, and welcome to the Setlist Podcast. This week on the show, we have Miles Gannett. Miles and I have a very in-depth discussion on psychedelics, its place in our culture, some of the folk heroes and figures in the space. We talk about where you come from and how it affects how you interact with the world. And we talk about the origin of his new album, Meridian. So, without any further ado, enjoy this conversation with Miles Gannett. I'm pronouncing your last name correctly. Is it Gannett?
It's actually Gannett.
Gannett? All right. I knew it was one of the two. Gannett. Yeah. I like Gannett better. That's much cooler.
So do I. It's like, you know, all the great musicians with a double syllable last name, you know, the emphasis is always on the first syllable, I think. Yeah. John Lennon, you know, like who else?
Well, yeah, Miles
Graham
Gannett.
Parsons.
You know. Yeah. Miles Gannett. Yeah, that's great. If you weren't a musician, I'm sure you'd be a cowboy. You know? Or maybe a little of both.
Maybe.
Well, congratulations on a very well done solo debut. It was fantastic. I really enjoyed it.
Thanks so much, Jacob.
Yeah. You know, I was curious. You had put out, I believe, three albums with Fractal Cat, which is a great name, by the way.
Thank you.
And it just seemed like you guys had really hit your stride and you were doing all kinds of things, very creatively and experimentally with your sound. What made you want to do a solo album? What made you want to branch out and do your own thing, Miles?
Well, it was a couple of things. Fractal Cat had, when I started it back in the... I guess I started recording the first Fractal Cat album in the late aughts, in like 2007. I set up a studio and started recording, and it was basically a solo project when it started. And I think 2010, I was still working on the album what was going to be the album, and I finally got a steady group of people together to play live. And it was initially a dilemma for me, like, did I want to call that stuff Miles Gannett, you know, but I felt kind of insecure about that. And like, maybe that would, I don't know, be vain or something to put my own name on something. But, sure. You know, so, and I like bands. I wanted to have a band and maybe, kind of have a band name to hide behind too, a little bit, you know? And that was a really interesting experiment and I got really close with everybody in the band, and we put out three albums, and by the third album it was really, you know, it was a band, and everybody was really involved, and we were building momentum. We'd hired this tour booking company to book a national tour for us, and we paid the company, and they took our money and booked like three
as they do.
Yeah, three shows or something. and then they filed for bankruptcy and didn't give us our money back. and probably against our better judgment, we decided to finish booking the tour ourselves. And there was some kind of rough stuff going on in some of the members' personal lives, which probably would have been good reasons to stay home also. But we just had kind of a rough experience on the road. And after that, so a couple of the members quit, and we put the band back together and did some live shows after that. But it really, you know, made me consider doing something different, because I'd been so invested in Fractal Cat, and that became so much of my creative identity. And then it when it felt like it was falling apart, it was like, it was almost like losing my own identity, you know?
Yeah.
Like, creatively. And also, I'd been getting like really into country music and bluegrass music, and I didn't feel like I could really do the kind of album that I record the songs that I was writing in the Fractal Cat context. Fractal Cat had become so much like a band sound that I kind of wanted a little more freedom to, you know, get members of the Seldom Scene on the record and have pedal steel and all of that stuff. So it felt kind of like a reinventing myself and, you know, and allowing myself to be a little bit vulnerable by putting my name on the record, you know, instead of a band name.
Right. I imagine it's like the difference between playing, you know, a team sport and an individual sport, you know?
Yeah. I mean, if you really want a band to work, like, well, I don't know if I can really advise on that from my experience, but you know, everybody became really invested in the band, and if you want it to be like a something where everyone's invested and everyone's contributing creatively, even if you're the main songwriter of the band, you have to let go of some control, and then some magic stuff can happen that way. But you know, it started to feel like it wasn't completely my vision for what I wanted to do anymore. And it had taken on a life of its own, which I still wanted to be a part of. And I still want to perform with Fractal Cat, but, yeah, it's, I learned a lot through that process. And I think it's kind of maybe feels better to, say, well, no, this is my project. It's got my name on it. And I want to get along with everybody I play with, and also I'm going to pay you, and you know,
yeah,
there's no confusion there.
right. Yeah, well, it's cool. I mean, and just to your point about, you know, having success with a band, just because a band ends doesn't mean they weren't successful, obviously. Like, right. Like you said, by the third album that you did with Fractal Cat, everybody was really dialed in, and you had a specific sound that was unique to you guys, and you know, it's a really cool thing. With your new album and your first solo album, Meridian, the big difference, you know, to me was some of the bluegrass influence that's peppered throughout, which was so cool. And what made you want to add that to your sound?
Well, I guess there's so much bluegrass in this area, and it had been happening around me, and I was sort of peripherally aware of it, because, you know, there's a lot of bluegrass in the jam scene, and playing in a psychedelic rock band, you know, I was around sort of jam grass bands occasionally, and it wasn't really until I heard the Seldom Scene, their album Live at the Cellar Door from, I think, the early 70s. I heard that and I just fell in love with it. And I was like, okay, I'd never heard bluegrass like this. Cause it wasn't exactly, I mean, it was definitely progressive, but it didn't sound like the sort of jam grass bands of today. It had all this harmony singing and more of like, it seemed really more connected to the 60s, folk revival movement, and it got psychedelic, and I just thought that was really great. And then I started getting into like J.D. Crow and the New South, and I heard Dillard and Clark's Fantastic Expedition of Dillard and Clark, and that quickly became one of my favorite albums. So it was also cool to discover the bands like the Seldom Scene, the Country Gentlemen, Ola Bell Reed, you know, people like that are really from this region, that I'm living in and playing music in. And it's the first time that I've really felt connected to this region musically.
You know? Are you still based out of Maryland?
Yeah.
Okay, cool. Yeah, you know, for somebody who hasn't spent any time really except passing through, I wouldn't have imagined there being such a, you know, big country and bluegrass scene. But we've had several people on our podcast that are performing in that area, and it seems to be a trend that keeps popping up.
Yeah, it's a big thing here, especially with the bluegrass. But more and more people are doing really interesting country and Americana and alternative country stuff too.
Yeah, you do something very cool with your music, Miles, which is this blend of bluegrass and country. And also the thing that really separates you is the psychedelic aspect of it and the themes that pop up and the sounds that pop up throughout the album. What was your inspiration for doing that? Because there's a very short list, as far as I'm aware, of people that are blending these things together.
Yeah, thanks. Well, I've been a psychedelic music fan since I was a teenager, and actually before that, because I was really into the Beatles when I was a little kid, and Sergeant Pepper was my first tape. So oh, nice. I've really been listening to psychedelic music since I was like 8 years old. And when I got into country music and bluegrass, it seemed natural to play with combining what's the psychedelic take on this music. And then when I found people like Dillard and Clark and stuff like Flying Burrito Brothers, John Prine's first album, some of Townes Van Zandt's early stuff, like people who had played around with putting psychedelic influences into this kind of music, I found that really inspiring. And and it was also like was inspiring that there's not too much of it. You know, I'm always looking for these like psychedelic bluegrass and folk nuggets. I was also listening to stuff like the Incredible String Band a lot, and thinking like, well, you know, we don't really have anything like that on this side of the pond too much, you know. In terms of like really sort of expansive psychedelic folk, there's stuff like Holy Modal Rounders, and I love the stuff they did, but just something about the way the Incredible String Band used instrumentation was really cool. If you're familiar with their stuff,
I'm
textural, you know, like, but they'd be using guitars and like all these different Middle Eastern stringed instruments and sitars, and you know, it's very 60s, but they kind of pioneered that sound over in Britain. And I just thought, like, wouldn't it be great to have something so layered and textural and psychedelic, but using, you know, fiddles and bluegrass guitars and pedal steel and dobro and really rooted in American music traditions.
Yeah, it's really cool. And I mean, the only thing that was comparable to me when I listened to Meridian was I had like a flashback of the first time I had heard Sturgill Simpson.
Oh yeah.
And I mean, he's such a hero of mine. When I heard, I think the first thing I heard from him was In Bloom. It was that cover of the Nirvana song that he did. And I was like, holy shit. I was like, this sounds like Merle Haggard took a dose of, you know, a hero's dose of mushrooms and then went and recorded a Nirvana song. And I had just never heard anything like it.
Yeah. Thank you for bringing up Sturgill. I would be seriously remiss if I didn't mention his influence. So I think in 2015, it was the drummer from Fractal Cat lent me his CD of Metamodern Sounds in Country and Western Music, and or metamodern sounds in country music. Yeah, that was really like the first time I'd heard really genuinely psychedelic country music. I was already listening to like Willie Nelson at that time, which, you know, like I love his stuff, and his stuff gets kind of, you know, trippy, he was definitely smoking stuff, but Sturgill was actually explicitly singing about right. psychedelics,
psilocybin and DMT,
right, and
to
also
hear his voice, you know, yeah. his voice doing it was just so unique.
Right, and the way he did it too was like so matter of fact and so like really country, you know, like, well, this is just life, but he's singing about his life, which includes you know, reptile aliens and all that.
Yeah, reptile aliens made of light. Yeah. Well, it was just so cool too, because and I say this because your album had a similar effect on me, where it's been so hard to find pure country music.
Yeah.
And, you know, that was one thing that my dad and I had, you know, a relationship based on, is like our enjoyment of really pure, I guess if you can say that, country music, where we used to listen to Willie Nelson and Waylon Jennings and, you know, Merle Haggard and Marty Robbins and that kind mm-hmm. of stuff. And
to, I love to all find, this stuff.
To find anything like that in the modern sense, anybody doing that, it's near impossible. Of course you can find folk music and stuff like that if you're looking, but to have somebody like Sturgill who sang that, and I could show to my dad, even though I think there couldn't be anybody further from being interested in psychedelic stuff than my dad, but him enjoying Sturgill Simpson, because unfettered country sound that was coming from him, but also the messaging of the psychedelics, it was just such a unique combination, and it's something right. that you've kind of come across in your music as well.
Yeah, and it was unironically country music too. Like the right. You know, there's a lot of stuff that is obviously like inspired by country music that I've heard that might be kind of psychedelic, but I don't know if the performers like felt kind of like self-conscious about making country music and you know, had to do an ironic twist on it, but I mean, Sturgill is, that's just his voice, the whole sound, it's like he really, you could tell he really loves country music, and he's also just genuinely psychedelic and spiritual in a psychedelic way. So
yeah, I know you talk about pretty early on in the album, I believe in your song The Lucky One, you know, seeming like reminiscing about your childhood, and I believe you talk a little bit about psychedelic experiences, and I thought that was just mm-hmm. a really cool song, especially when you add in what I perceived as being fortunate not to have all these technological burdens. I don't know if that was something you were going for, but for me, you were talking about all of these adventures and things that you did as a kid, and you were unburdened by the stuff that maybe this generation. Oh, did I lose you? But what I was saying before was that you talked about these experiences that you were able to have as a child in the song Lucky Ones, maybe because you were unburdened with the technology that this generation is, and you were lucky because you didn't have these technological advances.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. The song was actually inspired by a friend of mine shared an article on Facebook. Maybe that's ironic. it was about the Xennial micro generation, which, you know, is, some people theorize that there's a micro generation between Generation X and the millennials, who are characterized by having an analog childhood and a digital adulthood.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. So, and I was born in 1981, so I fell into that group, and I was reading the article and, about, you know, proto millennial people like myself, and One of the earlier names that was proposed for this micro generation was actually The Lucky Ones. So that's where the song came from.
And, yeah, makes sense.
Yeah. Yeah, and I just used examples or thought about experiences that my friends and I had, and that line you were talking about, we used to trip out in the woods by the banks of the creek.
Yeah, I know it's difficult for, or I imagine it's difficult for people growing up now to maybe have those experiences when everything is so digital.
Yeah. I think it probably varies according to region, but definitely like here in in Maryland where I'm at, it seems like the kids are pretty absorbed into technology. I do see some kids playing in the woods, which is nice, running around outside.
Yeah.
I don't know if they're on psychedelics. They seem a little young for that.
Right. What led, if you don't mind me asking, what led to your psychedelic experiences as a kid? I know you had mentioned Sgt. Pepper being an influence on you, but what led to you taking the leap?
Oh, peer pressure, I guess. I was 15, and a friend of mine just said, here, put this in your mouth. And I said, okay, because I thought, well, maybe I'll write great songs like the Beatles.
But you weren't wrong.
Well, thanks. I mean, and of course that I was totally unprepared for what that was. And so I read up on it and, read Aldous Huxley and Timothy Leary and all the stuff you're supposed to read and, as a teenager, and thought, okay, I'm going to be prepared next time. And and it really changed my life in a lot of ways, and continues to inspire me, even if I don't take those journeys as often as I did when I was younger,
Sure. Well, it seems to be a huge influence on your music, from the sound to the lyrics. I know you end the album with a really cool kind of ode to Maria Sabina.
Yeah. Thanks for mentioning Maria Sabina. Yeah.
Yeah. What made you want to include that in the album, or even end with that note?
A couple things. I went to college in Vermont at this really radical school called Goddard College. Actually, the members of Phish also went there. And
oh, no way.
Yeah. And it was an individual studies program. So a lot of my senior study had to do with psychedelic history and also like mythology and things like that, and I read and wrote about Maria Sabina in my senior study, and her story just really fascinated me, and I thought it was so sad and I was like, I don't know what, 30, I was at least 30 before I even knew who she was. So I thought, especially if people are listening to psychedelic music or taking psychedelic mushrooms, they should know Maria Sabina's story, because I think it's really tragic and really important.
Yeah, it is super interesting. So I personally haven't had any psychedelic experiences. I'm planning on, and I'd like to, but I'm fascinated with the world surrounding psychedelics. So for the past several years, I've been deep in learning about it. So I guess when I was listening to your song, I was kind of hearing the more tragic side of Maria Sabina's story, but maybe it's just because I haven't looked into that story recently. I'm not remembering what made it so tragic. I think about what a key role she played in everybody else being able to experience these mushroom ceremonies. And I guess a part of me has kind of overlooked maybe the more tragic side. So what is the story behind that, Miles?
Yeah. So as you know, Maria Sabina was a Mexican healer. She was a Mazatec Indian woman, and she healed people in mushroom ceremonies called veladas, or veladas. I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing it exactly right. And she would take mushrooms and she would give mushrooms to the sick, you know, the people who were coming to her for whatever kind of healing they needed, and she would just channel these words and songs. She would sing these improvised lyrics, and you can read transcripts, and it's really beautiful stream of consciousness poetry, which she attributed to the mushroom spirits speaking through her. And there's an amateur ethnomycologist named Gordon Wasson. He was a wealthy American banker, and as I guess his hobby or side pursuit, he was studying the history of mushrooms around the world. And his wife was a Russian woman named Valentina, who I think initially got him interested in mushrooms, because mushrooms are a really big part of Russian culture, and they have the Amanita muscaria right. shaman tradition there. So he had written a book called Mushrooms, Russia, and History, I think it was called. And he started hearing about the sacred mushrooms of Mexico and wanted to find out what that was all about. And he went down to Oaxaca and asked around and followed various leads. And he ended up in Maria Sabina's village and met her, and she invited him to participate with his crew who had come with him.
Was initially his crew, were they from Life magazine? Am I getting that right? Or was that later on?
It was him, his wife, a photographer, and this other guy who was an undercover CIA agent. In fact, all of Gordon Wasson's research into psychedelic mushrooms was, unbeknownst to him, funded by the CIA's MK Ultra project. You know, the project where they wanted to use psychedelics for mind control and warfare and stuff like that. They were disguised as some kind of academic grant, but it was really the CIA funding him. So they all sat in on this mushroom ceremony, or several mushroom ceremonies, and then Gordon Wasson wrote about it in Life magazine. And in the Life magazine article, he disguised Maria Sabina's name and her location. He didn't disclose any of that. But then when he published the second edition of Mushrooms, Russia, and History, he wrote a new foreword, and in the foreword he disclosed her name and location. And then of course it was the Beat era, shortly followed by the hippie era, and all these people started making pilgrimages, all these white people, first beatniks and then hippies, making pilgrimages to her village and camping out all around town. And at first people were you know, it was just a few people and they were respectful, but then more and more, you know, especially as the hippies came into the picture, I think in the 60s, people just really, like, some of them just wanted her to sell them mushrooms, and they didn't want to respect the traditions. And other people in the town started taking advantage of the situation and picking the mushrooms and selling them to the Westerners, to the white people who were showing up. and it really disrupted the culture and the tradition there, and people started to resent Maria Sabina for initially inviting these people to join in ceremony.
Right, within her own culture, right?
Yep, mm-hmm. Like her neighbors. And so, like, she was falsely accused by somebody else of selling marijuana, and the police came and confiscated all of her belongings and arrested her. And those charges were dropped because it was totally, totally bogus, but they never gave her stuff back. And then, you know, she was poor to begin with. She had a vinyl record of her chanting in ceremony that Gordon Rawson and Smithsonian Folkways had produced. She had one copy of that, and that was confiscated.
Ironic.
Yeah, I know. And then, you know, somebody from her village burned her house down, and then her son got murdered, you know. Mm. It was just really, really bad stuff happened. And she, you know, she survived all of that, and I don't know how she was at the end of her life, but I mean, those are just devastating consequences for introducing the Western world to psychedelic mushrooms.
Yeah, of course. And I mean, now, as your song demonstrates, she's become kind of a folk hero to the people that ultimately caused her downfall, in a sense.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah.
Really a really interesting paradox.
Yeah. So I think if you're going to, you know, lift her up as some kind of folk hero or psychedelic saint or something, you know, tell her whole story and be more respectful of indigenous traditions.
Yeah, it is tricky, though, right? I mean, so much, I think we probably both agree that so much good came from that. Of course, so much wrong as well.
Right.
It's just,
Good for whom, though, you know? That's the question.
That is the question. I mean, I guess if you did want to extrapolate, I feel like society may, as we're seeing kind of empirically coming from like Johns Hopkins University and things like that,
yeah,
society does stand to improve quite a bit if there is more of this kind of ritual taken, if people are experiencing psilocybin and other psychedelics, not everyone, of course, but
right,
more at scale. And maybe if you found that psychedelics were beneficial for your life personally,
mm-hmm,
then maybe, you know, there's an example of where people have gained from this, but of course, at what cost? And what is the sum total? Is it for better, right, or for worse?
Right. Well, you know, and that was the why I felt it was really important for me to write this song, because it, you know, it's kind of I have benefited, I think, so much from my psychedelic experiences and my experiences with psychedelic mushrooms, but as this sort of psychedelic, as the new psychedelic movement gets mainstreamed, you know, and we've got Hopkins and people fighting for legalization and psychedelic therapy and all this stuff, which I think could be hugely beneficial, I think it's just really important to make sure that we're addressing and confronting and dismantling systems of white supremacy, in, you know, because you know that permeates everything, including medicine and research, and make sure that we're giving back to the communities that we basically stole this knowledge from, you know, and make sure it's not just benefiting the privileged, you know, like I don't want psychedelic access to be restricted to people who can afford several thousand dollar retreats, you know, to like psychedelic wellness spas.
Well, right, of course. Yeah, it is interesting. I don't know if it's fair to say that it was stolen in the sense that, you know, like, I do see the errors in R. Gordon Wasson's ways. Obviously, it was an incredibly ill-advised misstep that I do think he came out and said, like, maybe in the 70s that he regretted.
Oh, definitely. Yeah, yeah, he definitely... He was definitely like, oh, whoops. and I know
time,
he,
whoops.
He tried to I know he remained friends with Maria Sabina throughout her life and tried to help her out. And, you know, in the song, I know I explicitly said, you know, it was Gordon Wasson's fault and kind of it's kind of severe.
Well, it was. I mean, totally fair to say.
Definitely.
But yeah, it's tricky. It is hard to figure out, you know, what's worth it and what, you know, what do you think the message should be going forward? I know this has turned into like a completely psychedelic episode of the podcast, but it's such a big part of
that.
Good. Yeah. It seems like it, man. You really knew that back and forth. And with it being such a big influence on the album and a big influence in your life, I think it's cool to talk about. And I'm kind of a geek in this way. So I'm glad you're so knowledgeable. What do you think is important going forward? And the lesson to learn, knowing that we can't change the past.
Yeah, of course we can't change the past. I think it's important to remember the past and tell stories like Maria Sabina's story, and try to give back to those communities. Make sure that any therapeutic access to psychedelics is not only for the privileged, and you know, I think for this medicine to do all the good that it could do, yeah, I think people really need to think about it, not to sound too academic, but to look at it kind of intersectionally, you know, consider all the ways the different oppressions and privileges tie into all of our institutions, you know. So whether it's healthcare or research or whatever else, you know, I think it's really important that we are addressing things like the history of colonialism and white supremacy, and not to call, you know, somebody like R. Gordon Wasson a white supremacist or a racist necessarily or anything. You know, it's just the systems that have historically been in place, the effect of Western people coming into indigenous spaces and spaces of people in color, you know, there's been a lot of harm done intentionally or unintentionally. So I think moving forward, it's just important to try to do better and to have indigenous people and people of color and different genders and identities who are given space to be leaders and so we're listening to diverse voices about this stuff, you know.
Right. Well, you know, it's interesting because in this sense, you know, I really don't think about this in terms, you know, of race or gender or anything like that, because with this specific subject, it seemed like it came down to kind of the powerful and the not so powerful, because all Americans have been, prohibited from having these kind of experiences, you know, of all race and all gender. And it was just, like you said, the very small group of people who were able to experience this without massive consequences. And I know Sturgill Simpson has that line, you know, tell me how you make illegal something that we all make in our brains, which is referring to DMT and not psilocybin. But yeah, it's just wild that this has been something that has been a part of human history for so long. And then in this short period of time, it's been completely shunned and excluded. And just now starting to pick up momentum for hopefully all people to be able to experience if they so choose.
Yeah, I hope so. You know, I think, and why, that's the thing. Why were these experiences, these plants, these fungi, these medicines, repressed, you know? And well, it was colonialism and Christianity. Really, because we had those traditions in Europe prior to Christianity,
right. And like you're talking about with the Amanita muscaria, with the
and
red
and
white mushroom.
Yeah, different pagan traditions, like other medicines, like Datura, I think, and I don't know too much about the use of psychedelics in European witchcraft, but I know, you know, that was happening. And so within European culture, and also in the context of colonialism of the Americas, there was a lot of repression done by the colonists. And I think it's totally insane that the prohibition and like hysteria around psychedelics, and I think you're right about like the dynamic between people in power and people without power, and especially in America, that's you know, that's always been the thing, the class struggle, the 1% and the poor.
Yeah, well, I do think that's been not exclusive to the United States.
Oh, but, yeah, of course not.
but certainly throughout time, there's definitely been a battle between the people who do hold the highest degree of power and those who don't. And fortunately, the one thing that you can say for certain within the system that we're in is at least we do get the, you know, the ability to speak and have open conversations about this and push back, even if it does seem futile most of the time. But it is nice to be able to push back.
That's
how you get the ball moving.
Definitely. I'm definitely grateful for being able to speak out and even talk about this stuff without being afraid that they're going to knock my door down or something.
Right. But, well, right. And I mean, your album's a great example of that, with all kinds of radical sounds and ideas, and radical in the best sense of the word. So what I was saying was, with your album, there are all kinds of things, like you were saying, kind of experimental and stuff out there that gets you thinking. Like the Lucky Ones that we were talking about earlier is a perfect example of being able to discuss things and put cool ideas out there and see where people take them. Your title track, Meridian, from what I could tell, had a pretty cool story as to why the album and that song came to be. Am I getting that right?
Yeah. Well, actually, the album was mostly recorded, or at least all the songs except for Meridian I had started recording when I took a vacation with my wife, and we drove down to Louisiana, and I'm actually from there. I showed her my hometown of Lafayette, and we hung around in New Orleans and had a great time. And then we were going to drive up to visit some friends in Nashville, and there were all these storms and tornadoes moving up and down the East Coast, and this storm hit us really hard, and we were looking for a place to spend the night and get some food, and the nearest place was Meridian, Mississippi. And I'd never heard of the place, never been there.
Great name for a town, though.
It is. It is. I thought it was really poetic because the name Meridian means midday, or and by extension it means the high point in civilization. Mm. But all of the architecture there, it was all this beautiful, beautiful architecture. But it was all in disrepair. And we drove around, even downtown, seeing these big, beautiful buildings that were just kind of had been weathered by time, and drove around and saw all these beautiful houses that were boarded up. And that really intrigued me. I was like, well, what happened here? And we met some really, really, really nice people. just really down to earth, and the lines in the song about there's still time to make conversation in the checkout line. Yep. And that was stuff that actually happened to me and my wife while we were there. We were checking out at this little cafe, and this couple started talking to us. It's like nobody cared if we were holding the line up or anything. It's just everybody was so laid back. And it was actually in that same cafe across the street, this church had bought all this gasoline to give away for free to the people in the town.
Whoa.
Yeah.
I knew that was a lyric in the song, but I wasn't sure if it was just a figure of speech.
No, that really happened. It was wild. When we got in, it was still raining, and we parked right in front of a statue of Jimmy Rogers, actually, who I'd heard Blue Yodel, and I was aware of who Jimmy Rogers was a little bit, but I didn't realize he was from Meridian at the time. And we went into the restaurant to get some food, and there was a country musician named Daniel House, really nice guy, playing chairs, and I asked if I could sit in, and we ended up jamming, you know.
Oh, no way.
Yeah, it was just a really crazy, magical experience. And when I got home, I read more about the history of the place. I read about it was a really big civil rights hub, apparently, and the activist James Chaney was murdered there. I didn't include any of that in the song because I just didn't feel like I had an angle to fit that in because I wanted to be more of a love song. But mm-hmm. Also the Kelly Williams, the queen of the Gypsy Nation, is buried there. And in 1915, when she died, the whole town was flooded by Romani people, and they had this huge party, It must have been like it must have seemed like Burning Man or something, you know, but in 1915. So that's where the line about, drinking crushed orange soda with the Romani queen, having a cemetery rave and all that. Apparently, right. Crushed orange soda was her favorite beverage. So people still put that up. People leave like packs of cigarettes and whiskey and orange soda on her grave.
My kind of lady.
Yeah, she seems like she was really cool.
Yeah.
And I guess the reason what happened with all those buildings and everything is it used to be a really booming place, and the town had a golden age. They call it a golden age from I think the early 1900s to the 50s, and then in the 1950s the railroad industry left town. And I guess the economy there never really recovered, or hasn't yet.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. It sounds like a really cool place. And it seems like it had a profound effect on you. What was it? I mean, clearly many factors make it a special place, but what do you think it was about all of those things that impacted you so much so that you named your named first the album. solo album after it.
Yeah. You know, like I started writing that song while I was in the hotel, you know, we were staying in like an Econo Lodge or what, you know, I can't remember, one of those, you know, cheap hotels. And I was working on the song there, and I finished it when I got home. And I think it was just something about the vibe of the place. And then I finished the song, and the next time I had a session at the studio, I had my drummer and my bass player there, and I said, well, I've got this brand new song, and I think it should go on the album. And we just cut it right there, put the basic tracks down, and it came together so nicely. You know, they learned it in the studio, and or we might have had one rehearsal where we played with it before that. I can't remember, but
it just came together naturally.
It just came together like that, and all the stuff about, you know, like sort of being inspired by some things from the past, like the music of the past. I thought the name Meridian was kind of fitting, you know, as this like this mythical golden age, which, you know, we kind of think of, or I kind of think of, you know, some past eras of American music in that way, you know. It really inspired me, and I don't know, just this idea of the midday sun and some golden age of music.
Yeah, well, look, man, you're painting a beautiful picture. It's like Meridian is gonna be on my short list of places to honeymoon. I mean, that's you're doing a great job. You should be part of their travel, you know, travel team.
Yeah. Yeah, that's funny. It's a really cool place. You should definitely check it out, you know, post-COVID. And really cool people there. I was only there for like less than 24 hours. So I was kind of kind of nervous, like, well, what are people in Meridian going to think of my little snapshot of the town, you know? Especially because I was like singing about the buildings being broken down and stuff. I didn't want to offend anybody, but really I thought it was just such a beautiful experience and a beautiful place. And I wanted that to come through, you know, more than anything in the
song. It certainly does. Yeah, it certainly does. It feels like a love letter to a special place in a different time.
Thanks. Yeah. The couple of people who I met down there, I sent it to them and they loved it. And so who knows, maybe it'll be the next Meridian, Mississippi anthem.
There you go. Yeah. Gonna be dropping off Crush, Orange Crush, and Miles Gannett CDs, you know.
I'm gonna have to move there.
yeah, you know, it's funny how a place like that can have an impact on you even if you just spend a short amount of time there. Is it radically different than the way that you live now or the way that you grew up? The lifestyle?
In Meridian?
Yeah.
You know, from what I saw of the lifestyle, it was more, a little more rural, and more southern than it is here in Maryland. I live right between DC and Baltimore, and you know, although I'm from the deep south, I'm from Lafayette. We moved up here my family moved up here when I was just five. So I did most of my growing up here, and you know, this is a very liberal area. I live in a town that was actually a planned community. Or a new town, if you're familiar with that concept.
No, I'm not. I have no idea.
Yeah, it was the town was designed by a mall builder named James Rouse, who's actually the uncle, I think, of the movie star Edward Norton.
Oh, really?
Cool. Yeah, Edward Norton lived here, and you know, he acted in the community theater here in Columbia, Maryland. And it was founded in the 60s with this sort of utopian ideal of oh, there's going to be all these like wooded paths, and every little neighborhood's going to have its own, they call them village centers, where there's like a grocery store, and you can get everything you need in walking distance. And I think the most radical thing about this city is that in the 60s, that when it was founded, one of the main ideas was that there wouldn't be any sort of segregation, any redlining or anything. So they were very intentionally mixing different racial backgrounds, ethnic backgrounds, and economic situations all in the same neighborhoods. And they really enforced that, like the realtors or developers would lose their licenses if they, for instance, only rented to white people in one block, you know. So they were really really serious about creating this this place where you would have you get to know people who came from different backgrounds from you and lived in different situations, and they wanted the place to look beautiful. Like there were no billboards on any of the roads, you know, and it's very hard to find gas stations here.
Yeah.
So it's a weird place, and right in between Baltimore and DC. So it's, you know, it's a very, very progressive area, and Meridian, I think, is, you know, a little more economically depressed than here, and more, definitely more conservative and more, more rural and more Southern, although, you know, Maryland is kind of Southern, but not like Mississippi.
No, certainly not. Well, it sounds like a cool place too.
What, Columbia, Maryland?
Yeah, where you're from. It sounds like,
yeah,
it's an interesting place, and I had never heard of did you call them like Concept City or
a new town or a planned community?
Planned community. Okay, cool. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's really interesting.
Yeah, it's a strange history. You should look it up. it's a weird place. I think Animal Collective are from here. They put out, or they're at least from this area. They put out the album Merriweather Post Pavilion, which, you know, is a famous concert venue that's in Columbia.
Yeah, there's this whole music scene that I guess I wasn't privy to that I'm learning about based out of Maryland. It's really cool, and it seems like you're a big part of it, and it's cool to see.
Well, thanks. I don't know how big a part of it I am, but you know, it's really cool to hear you say that, and I'm really glad to be a part of the really diverse music happening here in Maryland, and so many great bands and artists who have friendships and collaborations across genre. So it's not just about, you know, country music or rock music or jam music or bluegrass music, but it's just community of musicians who are all pretty open-minded, as far as I can tell.
Well, right, and that's a perfect microcosm of your album Meridian, where it's all these different ideas and different sounds that have come together to make something really beautiful.
Well, I appreciate it. Thank you.
Yeah, of course. So, Miles, let everybody know where they can find you if they want to learn more about you and follow what you're doing, and then where they can listen to the new album.
Yeah. So you can find me on the internet at milesgannett.com. It's MilesGannett. And I'm also on Instagram and Facebook and Twitter, although I think I'm most active on Instagram probably. And so I post all of my upcoming shows, which now there are a couple. There's going to be a virtual Great. Album release show on April 17th that you can watch from anywhere in the world. I'm assuming depending on the internet access.
Right.
You know, so that's going to be April 17th at 8 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, and I'm going to have a full band together to play the album. And I've got a couple of in-person shows that are starting to open up for the summer, so I'm excited about that. Finally being able to play in front of people again.
Yeah, it's an exciting time. Get everybody back out there and seeing live music. All right, Miles. Well, thanks so much for doing this. It was great getting to talk with you and learn more about your story.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me, Jacob. This has been a really fascinating conversation, and it's really cool to talk to somebody who knows so much about psychedelics, you know, before you've even tried them.
Yeah,
and knows, you know, is so into this kind of music, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, you're a great example of two of my interests colliding. So it's been great. Great getting to talk with you. Thanks again.
Thank you, man.
All right. Thanks for listening, and thanks to Miles for coming on the show. His new album, Meridian, is available this Friday for stream and purchase. Go check it out and check out his website and potentially get yourself a physical copy. You know, that is the best way to support the musicians you love. If you want to check out what we've got going on or support us, you can head to our website, setlist.community. That's where you're going to find previous podcasts, our blog posts, and our merchandise. If you want to be in the know, you can join our email list, and that's where you'll get a little heads up to our future podcast guest and some merchandise coming down the pipeline that I think you'll be excited about. I know we are. That's all I got for you today, guys. So if you enjoyed this, leave us a review. Or let us know with a rating, or silently enjoy it and just listen to it for intrinsic purposes. All right, guys. Thanks again. Take care. Peace.